Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us for the election show. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Richard Maurer, the Anchorage Daily News, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and by Skype from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Steve, the morning after the election, I ran into an old Democratic friend who said, "Boy, it is a great day to be a Democrat unless you live in Alaska." What do you suppose he meant by that?
Well, he's obviously very happy about President Barack Obama winning re-election in what was a very bruising campaign, and there were some doubts there, but he came through strong, so that's very good news for the Democratic Party. And they held on to the U.S. Senate, and the Republicans still have control of the U.S. House. If you're a Democrat and you live in Alaska, you got a bruising reminder of how tough it is to become to be a Democrat and get elected in this state. It was just another reminder of how difficult it is to beat the Republicans. And you had the added burden of overcoming, in my opinion, redistricting, reapportionment, where all the election lines were pretty much redrawn. It put incumbents against incumbents. It moved traditional boundaries to include more Republican voters in what were traditionally
Democrats. Some Democrats got moved into even more Democratic
That's right. And so it was just a reminder to Democrats how tough it is for them to get elected here, I think.
Jill, following on Steve, your assessment.
Oh, I think Steve's absolutely right. I know that outgoing GOP Chair Randy Riedrich was very pleased with redistricting. He felt that it returned the state to a more normalized version of neighborhood and like council representation that it had seen prior to the 2002 map, where he said that map basically executed sitting state lawmakers through the redistricting process, but by doing the very same thing, putting incumbents against incumbents, and only one of them was going to win. So that clearly played a big role. And I think there's also, you know, there's the where you fall on social issues and where you fall on fiscal issues. And I think we definitely had a strong case made from the oil industry and from the governor about why we needed a different approach to the tax issue here.
So. And it looks like we're going to have 28 Republicans in the House and 12 Democrats, and it'll be 7 Democrats and 13 Republicans in the Senate. Speaking of the Senate, let's go to Richard Maurer. Mm-hmm. This was the big story of this election.
Well, it certainly was. It was certainly leading up to it. It was the big story, and as it turned out, it was as well. The Senate went from a bipartisan coalition, which had 10 Democrats and 6 Republicans, to now at this point an all Republican majority, the 13-7. Presumably they're going to get a couple more Democrats in there, because 13-7, while it's strong, it could get a little raggedy at times. So they're going to want to get a couple more in there. But you know, I think we were talking about the numbers. It doesn't seem as bleak for the Democrats as you might imagine, in that it seems like a Democrat can win even when registration is strongly Republican. If the Democrat is a strong candidate, even if the Republican is a strong candidate. I think you saw that Bill Wilkowski was out, the registration outnumbers Democrats in his district 2-3, maybe a little bit more. He crushed Bob Roses, who was a very strong
Republican. He's a former legislator.
Former legislator, school union head. So that's nothing to sneeze at. Hollis French was basically 2-1 Republican to Democrat in his district. It looks like he's prevailing against another very strong candidate, Bob Bell.
Now, if I might, we know that French is ahead by about 250 votes. Do we have any idea of how many votes are out there?
I don't know. I think both sides are hoping that the absentees go in their direction. I think he's hanging by two fingernails.
Both candidates have told us anyways that they don't feel there's enough votes out there to change this lead right now. They both work the absentee ballots pretty hard, but Bob Bell told us the day after the election that he didn't think there was enough votes in those absentee ballots to put him over the top right. in this particular race. So he hasn't conceded yet, mm-hmm. but yeah. So
247, which is what the last count was yesterday, is a lot to make up at this stage of the game.
Yeah.
If they're 2,000, you have to win by 10%, 55-45.
Yeah.
Now, election night, Bob Bell expressed unhappiness about the way he'd been treated by his opponent, and I suppose by inference, the press. Does he have a case to make?
I don't know how that. One could always argue that there's negativity in a campaign. I don't think he was especially treated poorly. I think he did make that case. I think that's what happens in an election. There were some ethical issues that arose. Very interestingly, my first interview with him at the start of the campaign, yes. I walked into his office and he hands me a packet of papers about this thick. These are all the negative things that people may bring up against me. I want you to know what they are, and I want you to know my defenses. And I look at this list and I go, holy moly, that's a lot of negatives that you yourself have identified, you know?
Well, I guess that approach is better for me to tell you the truth than my opponents to lie about me. I don't know if it works, but...
I don't either, but it certainly threw me back a little bit.
Okay, one more thing here, Richard. We'll stay with you. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the new Senate organization, which we just learned about on Wednesday, Thursday, and it's gotten a little bigger.
It has gotten a little bigger. It started out 11-9, which is unstable. Because all it takes is one person to switch. It's now all the two Republicans who are left out of it were the two who were most associated with the coalition, the Senate President, Gary Stevens from Kodiak, and Bert Stedman, the co-chair of the Finance from Sitka. They've now come in, although it greatly reduced.
I know
roles.
It's a come down to go from committee from president of the Senate to committee chairman, but mm-hmm. actually it struck me that Stevens and Stedman's may have made out better than they could have expected their chairman of committees.
Their chairman of committees, I guess. You know, I guess you could say that. Although, you know, again, Stedman was co-chair of finance. That's pretty important spot.
Yeah,
maybe even more important
than Senate president.
Maybe even more important than Senate president.
Okay, let's go to Dermot Cole. Dermot, the Fairbanks returns, especially in the Senate, were crucial in the outcome of this election and the organization in Juneau. Tell us what happened in those big Senate races in Fairbanks.
Well, Mike, you don't have to be Nate Silver to figure out what happened here. The three senators are all Republicans, replacing two Democrats. Both Joe Thomas and Joe Pascavan were defeated. Joe Thomas ended up being in the same district as John Coghill, a heavily Republican conservative district, and Coghill won that handily. Thomas ran a pretty strong negative campaign against Coghill, but it didn't succeed, and I don't think many people expected it to succeed. It was a very strongly a district that was not going to be in his favor at all. So Coghill won that fairly easily. Click Bishop, the former labor commissioner, didn't have a strong challenger in the general election. His major challenge was in the primary when he defeated Ralph Seekins, a former state senator. Click Bishop is probably the most moderate of these three. Pete Kelly, former state legislator, came back and defeated Joe Pascavan. They had a pretty, you know, divisive campaign between Kelly and Pascavan. Pascavan was pretty negative about Kelly. Kelly responded in kind. There was also a lot of money from outside groups, basically, that sort of added to the negative flavor of that whole race.
If I might ask, Dermot, what was the negative on Pascavan? If there were outside groups advertising, what were they saying about him?
Well, part of it was trying to link Joe Pascavan to President Obama.
Oh, is that right?
There was a yes, and Rich wrote a pretty good story about that in the Anchorage Daily News on that campaign. You know, oil taxes came up during this race, but not to the level that you might expect. It was a sort of a understated issue, at least from the Republican side. From the Democratic side, they made much of the campaign heavily on the opposing the so-called $2 billion giveaway.
Let's get Richard Maurer to hear from it.
That did not succeed.
Dermot, do you think now the one of the challenges to the original redistricting plan came from the Fairbanks Democrats? They at one point, Joe Pascvan and Joe Thomas, the two Democratic senators, were in the same district. There was a suit, and they split apart. But that was a pretty strong Democratic district, I think. And the effect of splitting them apart ended up with both Joes being defeated by Republicans. Do you think that maybe that was a mistake? If they were both in the same district, there would have been a primary fight. One, Thomas or Pascvan would have won, and then probably continued on to win in November. And then you'd have, instead of a 7-13 Senate, you would have an 8-12, which potentially leads to a coalition. What do you think about that?
Well, that's more math than I can handle, I think, Rich. I think it's, you know, I guess you could make an argument that would work that way. Mm-hmm. You could also say that, I'm not sure exactly how those boundaries would have been drawn, but had Thomas and Pascvan faced each other in the primary, it's possible that Pete Kelly would have run against either one of them and done pretty well and probably won. There wasn't a huge margin in that Pascvan Kelly race, no. But I hate predicting elections because I'm never right. It's a lot easier to second guess things, because you can never be wrong.
Well, the election's over now, so you can be right. Let's go back to Steve McDonald. Steve, what happened in the House of Representatives?
Well, the House picked up a couple of new members. It's a 28-12 advantage for the Republicans. They organized today. And
tell us about that.
Mike Chenault will be the speaker. So you have a familiar face. Mike Chenault out of Nikiski is the speaker of the House game. So he'll run things. Whether the new faces in the House, are they going to change anything as far as oil taxes and what the governor wants? That's going to be...
Did they tell us who the finance chairman are?
I do have something here. Let's see now. I can read this thing.
In their press availability or however they did.
Finance is going to be Bill Stoltz. Yeah. Bill Stoltz out of Chugiak and Alan Osterman. They were selected as finance co-chairs in that. So Bill Stoltz, who ran unopposed in this
And was trying to get some traction to run for House Speaker, but failed apparently in that.
And so he's going to be co-chair of the Finance Committee, and that's a pretty potent spot to be in.
Anything to add there?
Yeah, I think that's also very interesting because Osterman was one of only two Republicans to vote against House Bill 110, which the big oil tax bill in 2011 that ended up dying in the Senate. And the fact that he's now sitting on House Finance could signal that the new version of House Bill 110, if it even comes out, could be in a little more interesting position.
And he's interesting, too, because his senator is in the... from his district is Gary Stevens.
Right.
So they would have been aligned on that particular matter. Let's go back to Jill Burke. Jill, the congressional race was a blowout. Don Young won quite handily, and Sharon Cisna got around 28%, which may be sort of the bottom for what a Democratic candidate can get in a statewide race.
Yeah, she performed, if you look just at Don Young's races over the years, 20-some odd, 21, 22 elections, in the bottom five. And it's a pretty bad result, I would think, or is actually. And I think one of those, bottom five races was a race where there was a three-way race and somebody got 14%. So, Young has a history of winning fairly strongly. Even his closer calls have had fairly good margins between them.
And after the election, I saw in the paper he was complaining about the President of the United States.
Obama-wama,
calling him names. You sort of have to wonder, okay, I'm going back to Washington. I'm fifth in seniority in the House of Representatives, but what do I do as Don Young?
I think you continue to do what Don Young has always done, which is kind of beat the path, fight for Alaska, be your own kind of rogue guy,
right.
I mean, he said he has no intention of going anywhere, and he's shown that he's capable of beating any opponent, and he says so quite openly. I mean, it sounds haughty to those who are hearing it, and to him, he just feels like he's being plain spoken, but he's managed to show that.
Yeah, with Sharon Cisna, he knew he was going to win and was usually, when I saw them together, a gentleman. It wasn't like Captain Zero with Parnell.
No, that was a little bit more.
Parnell was a real candidate.
Yeah.
And he barely squeaked through.
Right, yeah.
Don Young barely squeaked through that
one. Steve.
In the primary.
Right.
Yeah.
He may have more opposition in his own party than he gets from the Democratic Party. He told
me on
Tuesday night, he said, there are a lot of Republicans in this room who don't think I'm Republican enough. And I took that to mean that the new leadership coming into the GOP in Alaska, the people who are more aligned with the Tea Party, feel that he's not conservative enough. And he's not looked down very favorably within some of the leadership positions
of the party.
Well, he hasn't
been a Tea Party person necessarily. He'd never signed Grover Norquist's no tax pledge.
Right. That's right.
He's not a fan of the Patriot Act.
Right.
So there's some things that could get some people riled up.
Yeah, and I think he has. It was an interesting comment. He didn't really elaborate more on it any more than that, but he just says there are a lot of people in this room, Republicans, who don't like me and feel that I'm not Republican enough. It was an interesting comment to hear.
Go ahead, Richard.
He's always had a lot of labor support. I think he's favored project labor agreements and on North Slope projects, and he's a big spender.
Yeah, he's always been a big spender. Mm-hmm. Steve, let's talk about our senators here. What lessons, first of all, can Mark Begich draw from this election?
He's going to face a tough. That's going to be a marked seat, I think. A marked seat. Okay, Mark Begich. But I think he's going to be a target. He'll be a target in a couple of years. I don't think he has stopped running since 2008. I think he just continued the campaign. He's been very aggressive. He's always been out in front of the public and letting everybody know what he's doing, which is the job of a politician. But I think he's going to face a tough test. We don't know exactly who's going to run against him. There's a lot of speculation that it might be Governor Parnell might run against him. Joe Miller always on small surfaces. But whomever it is, it's going to be one of the best that the Republicans have. And he'll have a tough fight on his
hands.
Well,
there's also a theory that before a Republican even gets started, and this is what happened in other races, he'll be able to raise many, many millions of dollars and just show them what a serious uphill race they face. And also, he's got this model, I think, in John Tester in Montana of somebody in a red state who was a Democrat who was going to have a very tough race and pull it off against a congressman.
Yeah. Well, that good point about the money. I think he is ahead now of where he was a couple of years ago in terms of raising money. He's well ahead. And that may be a product of, people back then didn't think he had the chance against Ted Stevens. He's raising more money. I think people look at him as a very strong candidate in his own right. And when you look at it philosophically, is he that different from the two Republicans who are a part of the congressional delegation?
Oh, that's right. Although some people would say definitely yes. Yeah. Jill, I just thought about this. You are a resident expert on all things Joe Miller. And where does this leave the Republican former nominee? Is there a road here for him? Is the Tea Party going to march off into history? What do we think?
I think time will tell. I think it's tough to tell exactly what Joe Miller's future aspirations are. He's kind of refashioned himself to be an online publisher. That's a very kind of Tea Party-oriented website. He actively, aggregates and collates material for that and also writes his own column, and his wife is writing his own column. And I kind of have the impression he enjoys being this kind of quasi-celebrity pundit who can go out and make speeches and rabble-rouse a little bit, but whether he's willing to jump back in and make another go of a significant race, I think remains to be seen. I think that's a decision he'd have to weigh very carefully.
An everyday question, where does he live now?
I don't know the answer to that. Maybe he can call and let
us
know.
This is the old business about on the web, you don't need to have a mailing address. And Richard, one thing that occurred to me after I put together the budget for the show was Lisa Murkowski has a real missed opportunity in here. If the Republicans had taken the Senate, she would be a committee chairman. Now she goes back to being a ranking member. Mm-hmm. So there was some her colleagues kind of let her down in this race, I think, some of the ones running for U.S. Senate.
Well, certainly, but again, that was the Tea Party influence that probably destroyed at least a couple of them. And I think that just as Joe Miller could not win his race against a riding candidate, I don't know where he would go given that history, there were several Republicans who put their feet in their mouths and trashed the Republicans' hope of winning. And I think, you know, but Lisa Murkowski, she plays the center. She kind of watches out for both herself and the state of Alaska. I think she'll do fine in the position she's in.
Yeah, and going back to what Jill was talking about with Joe Miller, if you're Joe Miller, how do you go to people who finance big elections and say, you know, I blew that last election, but I won't blow this one. How about $10 million? I think that's a pretty tough sell.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay, Richard, let's continue here. Mm-hmm. All the judges in South Central Alaska were retained, but one of the races involving Jen Sintan was close, 53-46 or 7, something mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. and which we had a lot last-minute sort of controversy about his service on the bench.
Right, and that was Jim Inouye and his Alaska Family Council talked about a couple of decisions that Judge Tam made on abortion questions and state law, and that probably raised the number of people who would vote against. I think in this state, it seems like one third or so of the voters will walk into that booth, see a judge, and vote no. I mean, I think that's
they're remembering their divorce, their child,
whatever
custody
their speeding
case,
ticket,
their father,
whatever it is, whatever, or just authority. You know, we don't like authority.
Yeah, that's a good.
You
one.
Know, what's
yeah.
more, what's a bigger symbol of authority than a judge?
They either vote no, or they don't vote at all because there's a lot of ovals
right,
to fill in.
Right. So the fact that Judge Tan got a few more negatives, but that he did not lose, I think that's pretty interesting. And that was partially, probably has something to do with the Judicial Council coming out and saying, wait a second, folks, this guy's got great ratings from the cops, from the attorneys, on, and you're going to throw him out over some ideological issue that has nothing to do with the law. And I think probably enough people saw that and responded and didn't take the negative idea that they voted him out.
Yeah, I was just going to tell folks that I did a little homework on this, and about 121,000 people voted in all the judicial races in Anchorage, except this race involving Judge Tan was close to 127,000 people voted. It was the largest turnout for any of the judicial races, and I don't know, did those 5,000 people all vote against him? Were there people who came out mm-hmm. and wanted, you know, filled out only one name on the ballot, and that was his? We don't get, Richard's right, we get about a third of the people who vote against any judge, no matter who it is, and would vote against John Marshall if he was on the on there. But in this case, I'm not sure what the lesson is. Is it that you can, if you start earlier and have more money, you can beat a sitting judge, or it's really hard to beat a sitting judge? Even if you have that, what do you think?
I think that they, you know, and I think it's a good thing that they just come up for retention every 6 years, that they don't have to run for re-election. So they're pretty obscure. They're there. They pop up on the ballot. Not a lot of people know anything about it. And I think any time that somebody comes out, like a Jim Minery or any other group for that matter, if they came out and all of a sudden elevates this person into the public spotlight, you're going to call attention to that. And yeah, you're right. He passed by a healthy margin. He won retention. Most of the judges, I was looking at the margins of victory, most of them gathered 63 to maybe 67%. There was some maybe a little higher. I think one judge got into the 70s. He was right around the mid-50s or so. Still a healthy margin.
Okay, Jill, what happened with the Constitutional Convention and the bond?
Okay, Constitutional Convention went down in flames. It's the fifth time, I think, since the inception of the Alaska State Constitution that has happened. It comes up every 10 years.
It was like 31% or something?
Yeah, it was 68 to 32. So, you know, defeated by a healthy margin, the people for it said, look, it's time to reevaluate the Constitution, especially some Alaska Native leaders said, we want our hunting and fishing rights evaluated, we want our Native sovereignty evaluated, we want it established, we want a legislature that's more representative of ourselves. And there was a former state attorney general who had argued that there were some other points that made it a worthy cause, including maybe we should look at making it a single chamber body instead of a two-chamber body. But I think the argument against it is that the amendment process works, that conventions don't necessarily need to be called in order to make changes to this document to meet the times and needs of the people. With respect to the bond, a huge transportation bond, one of the biggest in state history, $453 million, that also passed. It had some stinky baggage attached to it, including $50 million for the Port of Anchorage, which has become a controversial, bloated project, with now some speculation that the project that's already underway may have to be scrapped and redone because it wasn't the proper design. There were some local projects in Fairbanks and Sitka that locals there did not support, but the kind of overall approach to these big bonds is you get a lot of projects from all around the state, someone's going to vote for it. The state wanted it because they argued we could spend the money now and repay it at a lower rate than we can invest our existing assets and get higher returns on them. But if Dermot can do this quickly, he made a great point about how this is not fiscally defensible.
You're going to have to make it for him because we can't get through it.
Okay, smoke and mirrors. It's a bad way to do budgeting. It's actually increasing the spending of the state budget by selling to the voters. Mm. You're not spending as much money on projects because you're bonding it instead of putting it into
about,
the capital budget.
With no campaign against the bonds, about 44% of the voters voted against him. Well, we're out of campaign time and out of all other time. See you next week right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.